Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Saturday the 6th of June, these are our main stories. The American states of California and Minnesota are to restrict police officers from using chokeholds following the death in custody of the unarmed black man George Floyd. The leader of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has been killed in Mali, according to a French minister. And the UN nuclear watchdog has complained that Iran is denying its inspectors access to two sites it wants to visit. Also in this podcast.
I have never gone without dancing for so long, so many months without dancing, because I love tango.
The problems of being a 95-year-old tango dancer during the pandemic in Argentina. Police in the U.S. city of Minneapolis have been banned from using chokeholds following the death of a black man, George Floyd, in their custody. In California, the governor, Gavin Newsom, has called for new restrictions on the police use of force, in particular on the carotid restraint, which blocks the flow of blood to the brain. Against this background, there is growing anger at the levels of violence meted out in the policing of demonstrations sparked by Mr. Floyd's death, and several investigations have been opened. In the city of Buffalo, in upstate New York, two police officers have been suspended after being filmed shoving an elderly man to the ground. They are seen walking by as the man lies motionless, bleeding from one ear. In Minneapolis, where the protests began following the death of George Floyd, three police officers have appeared in court, charged with aiding and abetting his murder. Our North America correspondent Aleem Makbul reports.
It is disturbing footage from a demonstration in Buffalo, New York, that's hit the headlines today. A 75-year-old protester calmly approaches police and is shoved to the ground. He's seen motionless and bleeding from his skull as police file past without coming to his aid. Two officers have now been suspended. But it's the latest in a string of incidents caught on camera of apparently unjustified use of force by police at these protests in the name of stopping rioting. There have been numerous assaults on peaceful protesters, arrests that appear to have little explanation, moments where police cars have been seen driving at protesters, and of course the gassing of peaceful demonstrators well before curfew. All particularly troubling given the incident that sparked all of this. Three officers have now appeared in court charged with aiding and abetting murder, in addition to the officer already charged with murdering George Floyd in Minneapolis. The president's called for authorities to continue to be tough on the streets, but has also talked of equality for black people.
We all saw what happened last week. We can't let that happen. Hopefully George is looking down right now and saying this is a great thing that's happening for our country. This is a great day for him. It's a great day for everybody. This is a great day for everybody. This is a great, great day in terms of equality.
It's easier to say African Americans need to receive fair treatment, but given the issues surrounding police culture and racism in this country, for generations, it's proved far harder to achieve in practice.
That was Aleem Makbul. Well, President Trump sounded happy on Friday and insisted that America was on its way to being great again. Following the announcement that 2.5 million jobs had been created, the president likened the U.S. economy's recovery from COVID-19 to a rocket ship.
This is outstanding what's happened today. Now, they thought the number would be a loss of 9 million jobs, and it was a gain of almost 3 million jobs. I think it was incredible in a couple of ways. The numbers are great, and this leads us on to a long period of growth. We'll go back to having the greatest economy anywhere in the world, nothing close. And I think we're going to have a very good upcoming few months.
Samira Hussein in New York told us that analysts haven't been expecting these figures.
to say that it's a surprise is really a bit of an understatement. I think there was a collective sort of intake of breath when we saw that the numbers actually reflected that the American economy added 2.5 million jobs in the last month, when the estimates were expecting that the unemployment rate for the month was going to exceed 20%. In fact, it's now 13.3%, which is lower than the May monthly jobs number, which was about 14.7%.
And where is the recovery happening? Which sorts of jobs?
If you look at the sectors that have seen an increase in jobs, unsurprisingly, we're seeing the hospitality and leisure sectors. Remember, these are things like bars and restaurants, which were closed immediately and were really badly hit at the height of sort of the coronavirus lockdown measures. And other sectors that we're seeing in job increase is the health and education sectors and construction as well.
Now, he's talking about a rocket ship recovery, but as you pointed out, we're still looking at an unemployment rate of 13.3% compared to, I think, slightly over 3% in March. Does this rocket ship recovery look like it could happen?
We still are talking about 42 million Americans that are out of work. And this kind of recovery is assuming that economies can just reopen and that, you know, there may not be some sort of second wave with the coronavirus. But remember, we are trying to deal with a health pandemic that people still don't really understand that well. So I think it's really hard to say whether or not there's going to be this kind of rocket ship recovery, because we don't have a firm grasp on how COVID-19 will react in the coming months.
That was Samir Hussain in New York. In a separate development, President Trump has directed the Pentagon to withdraw almost 10,000 US troops from bases in Germany by September. He wants a permanent cap on American troop levels of 25,000. It's the latest drawdown of US forces abroad under the Trump administration. France says its forces in northern Mali and their allies have killed the leader of the militant group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Youssef Taha has more details.
The French Armed Forces Minister, Florence Parly, said Abdelmalek Droukdel, who's an Algerian national, was killed in what she described as a daring operation on Wednesday along with several members of his inner circle. Ms. Parly called it a major success in the fight for peace and stability in the region. Droukdel was Algeria's most wanted man for years. He was sentenced to death by an Algerian court in 2015 for acts of terrorism during that country's civil war in the 1990s. The French military has been actively supporting the Malian government for several years in its attempts to crush Islamic insurgents in the north.
That was Youssef Taha. The UN's nuclear watchdog has expressed its serious concern to Iran. The Vienna-based IAEA said for months Tehran has failed to allow access to sites it wants to visit. Alan Johnston reports.
The agency says that for more than 4 months now, its inspectors have been prevented from examining two suspect locations. It's not clear exactly what might have happened at the sites, but it's believed the activity took place long before 2015. That's when Iran agreed to curb its nuclear ambitions in a deal struck with the US, European states and other countries. Iran denies that it has ever sought to develop nuclear weapons. It says its programs have been peaceful.
That was Alan Johnston. There's growing concern that South Africa might see a big rise in coronavirus infections. The country's top vaccine expert is warning that hospitals could be overwhelmed by new cases within a matter of weeks. Hospitals in Cape Town are already near capacity, and the infection rate is reported to be rising sharply across the south of the country. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports from Johannesburg.
After a promising start, South Africa is running into trouble. Intensive care beds in Cape Town are already full, and doctors are warning that many hospitals there will be overwhelmed within weeks. In the southeast of the country, in the poor and notoriously badly run province of Eastern Cape, the situation is looking even worse. One of the country's top COVID-19 experts, Professor Shabir Mati, said South Africa's sudden surge of infections was a warning sign for the rest of the continent.
There's very few countries that are anywhere close to the peak of where Africa is going to be when it comes to the outbreak, including South Africa. And that peak is coming. So we're already seeing it in the Western Cape. We're already seeing it in the Eastern Cape in South Africa. In 2 weeks from now, they won't be able to admit to the ICU, essentially. In a month's time from now, the service is going to be unfortunately overwhelmed, and there's no getting away from that.
All this comes just as South Africa begins to ease tight lockdown restrictions. The country's test and tracing system, which had been impressive, is now woefully overloaded. The idea that Africa as a whole might be spared the worst of the pandemic, perhaps because of a warm climate and a particularly youthful population, is now being dismissed by many experts as wishful thinking.
That was Andrew Harding in South Africa. Severodvinsk was once one of the most secretive places on Earth. It's in the Russian Arctic and is now well known for producing nuclear submarines, but it's still difficult to get access to. The thing is, though, the city's COVID infection rate has shot up, and now that information has surfaced, it's about to be sealed off from the outside world. We heard from Olga Ivshina of the BBC Russian service.
In the 1990s, the city indeed was quite secretive, so to say, quite mysterious, especially for foreigners, because you couldn't get in so easily. But actually now it's open for Russian citizens. Previously, if you look at Google Maps, you would never see two main factories which operate there, the one which produces nuclear submarines and the second one which repairs them. But actually now, you know, you can easily find those images on Google and even on Google Street View. So it's not that secretive anymore in general, but of course, certain amount of secrecy remains in any question connected to those two factories.
So what's going on there right now then?
So basically, as far as we know, the rate of people infected with coronavirus in Severodvinsk is way higher than on average in this region. Just to explain this, generally in Arkhangelsk region, roughly 2,000 people are ill, and from that quantity, nearly 1,000 is from Severodvinsk, and additional 1,300 people in Severodvinsk are self-isolating at home and are viewed by the doctors. So the figures are quite significant for such a small city where less than 200,000 people live. So it is quite a significant number of people infected.
And how did we find out about it? How did this amount of information get out?
When people get worried, they go and post on social media, especially in Russia, where people experience lack of access to independent media. So, you know, when they have troubles, they tend to talk about it online rather than go to journalists because it's hard to get to independent journalists. But then, you know, the pressure probably was increasing and the official information also appeared. But in order to get all the details, my colleague, I had to call to a few Severodvinsk hospitals, pretending he's not a journalist.
That was Olga Ivshina. The celebrated Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra has held its first live post-lockdown concert, Beethoven's Fifth, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. It was streamed live, so music lovers were able to take part remotely. However, in line with COVID-19 regulations, only a fraction of the 2,000 concert hall seats were used. Bethany Bell reports.
The Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra is back with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. The performance was attended by a tiny audience. It took place in the famous Golden Saal in Vienna's Musikverein Concert Hall, which normally hosts up to 2,000 people at events like the New Year's concert. But just 100 people were allowed to attend because of coronavirus social distancing regulations. Daniel Barenboim said it was an important moment.
I think it's wonderful, and this is the message that the Vienna Philharmonic and I want to give, that we start again with the live music making. And we hope we only have 100 people in the audience. It's not very much, but it is a beginning. And this is how music can and should be experienced live.
All the players tested negative for COVID-19 before the concert. The orchestra hasn't played in public for 3 months. The first violinist, Daniel Froschauer, said it was the first time in its history that the Vienna Philharmonic had such a long break between concerts.
It's the first time we can play together again. So for us, it's really a way to find our way back into cultural lives and a life that we have been really missing for 3 months.
For members of the audience like Ingeborg, it was a sign that things were getting better.
It was wonderful after Corona for the first time that we could go back to our Golden Hall and have the Vienna Philharmonic play for us with Daniel Barenboim. Wonderful program, Mozart and Beethoven, and they played exceptionally well. It was just absolutely wonderful, and we are all happy.
That report by Bethany Bell. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
All passengers for Palestine, this way!
Miriam.
I am a Jewish woman. I have no homeland other than this. My mother and I fled fire and hatred, came here and met it again.
And Yusuf.
When I was a boy, there was nothing between here and Al-Quds, Jerusalem. But there was never a question that this was our homeland.
The podcast drama from the BBC World Service.
There's a cycle here. Disturbances, bloodshed. It's vital we don't overreact.
Telling the story of the founding of Israel.
500,000 Arabs under Jewish rule and 10,000 Jews under the Arabs.
How will that work? How can we split this tiny land?
Miriam and Yusuf. Search for Miriam and Yusuf, that's M-I-R-I-A-M and Y-O-U-S-S-E-F, wherever you get your podcasts.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to affect countries worldwide, questions are being asked like, is it a winter disease rather than a summer one? James Menendez spoke to Michael Ward, Professor of Veterinary Science at the University of Sydney. His team have been investigating the seasonal differences in transmission of COVID-19.
We've looked at some of the associations between weather and COVID-19 cases, and we're finding humidity seems to be a driver of disease occurrence, so low humidity. And in some other research, temperature also seems to play a role, so low temperatures. So you put the two together and sort of those dry winter sort of conditions seem to be promoting COVID-19.
Why do you think low humidity encourages transmission?
Well, it's probably because at low humidity, there's less water in the air, so the air's dry. And when you have an infectious person who sneezes, coughs, those aerosols tend to be small and they stay suspended in the air for longer than when it's humid conditions. So it sort of makes sense that it would be those dry conditions that lead to more transmission.
And when you're talking about these conditions, it's not just outside, it's inside as well, isn't it?
That's right, except the studies and studies that have been done. There's been a couple of studies now and also on SARS and MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. They have used weather-recorded humidity as well as temperature because we don't actually have the recordings from inside people's homes. So, you know, that sort of study would be very difficult to undertake. So we use weather recordings data as a proxy for wherever people might be.
But it's fair to say, though, that in winter, you've got cold, dry air outside. That's been heated, which can dry it out even more. So the conditions inside people's homes and offices may be more conducive to spreading the disease. Is that fair?
Yes, that's what we're saying. And the other factor here is also changes in behaviour. So, of course, in winter, people are inside more. They're also more clustered together. So that might be the other factor. So we can't actually tease out which is the more important. We just know that more cases seem to be occurring when we have these dry humidity.
And how conclusive is the science at the moment? What are you calling for more research to be done?
Well, I think we just have to wait and do more research this year. So far, this is only the second report, peer-reviewed publication, and it's from the Southern Hemisphere. We did one in China. Previously, there's been a couple of studies on SARS and a couple of studies on MERS. They've all found the same thing, so it's sort of pointing in that direction. But we've only been going 6 months, so we'll see what happens in the Southern Hemisphere during winter. And then probably in the Northern Hemisphere, when you come into winter, that'll be a test to see what happens.
That was Professor Michael Ward from the University of Sydney. The European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, has said there's been no significant progress in talks with the UK about a future trade deal. Speaking after the latest round of negotiations, he accused the British government of backtracking from undertakings in the political declaration agreed by Brussels and London.
This document is available in all languages, including English. We cannot and we will not accept this backtracking on the political declaration. And at the same time, we will request the full respect of the withdrawal agreement.
Here's our Europe editor, Katia Adler, who's in Brussels.
There have been four rounds of negotiations so far since the UK left the EU, and there's been no progress at all on the key sticking points between the two sides. So that's over EU rights to fish in UK waters. It's also on so-called level playing field conditions. That's basically the EU saying there has to be fair competition between the two sides after Brexit. So competition regulations. Also, how the whole deal should be formed, never mind key parts of its content and so on. There's no progress on those at all. So we've had once again a real downbeat assessment from the main negotiators on both sides. And also, if you just imagine on a human level, because trade negotiators are human, they're negotiating screen to screen rather than face to face. And that is important because when you do have those key sticking points, it sometimes helps to have an informal chat around the water cooler or over a cup of coffee or maybe have a stroll around the block. And that has not been possible to date. There is a summit at the end of this month where Boris Johnson is going to meet the President of the European Commission and the President of the European Council, and it's expected they're going to try and sort of put a bit more dynamism into the whole process and say, look, let's speed up the rate of these negotiations. But something else that makes these extraordinary talks, Kristen, is first of all the tight timetable that we've already alluded to, and also trade negotiations are normally between parties that want to get closer together. And of course, after the UK has left the EU, this deal is going to push the two sides further apart. So all of these tensions come into play.
That was Katia Adler in Brussels. Here in Britain, the Crown Prosecution Service has been asked to review evidence in the death of a black transport worker who died of COVID-19 after she was allegedly spat at by a man who said he had the virus. An initial decision by police to close the case of Belly Mujinga had sparked a lot of anger at the London Black Lives Matter protests. Bahana Darwood reports.
Black Lives Matter! The name of Belly Mujinga has been prominent at demonstrations this week. Protesters have been demanding justice for the London train station worker, holding up placards and banners dedicated to her. And now, in recognition of the wider public interest in the circumstances of the case, Britain's Transport Police have invited an independent review by the Crown Prosecution Service. Mrs. Mujinga died in April after contracting COVID-19. She fell ill with the coronavirus days after it was alleged a man spat and coughed at her and a colleague at Victoria Station in London. He also allegedly said he had the virus. An investigation by Britain's Transport Police took no further action in the case because they didn't find any evidence of either of the allegations. The man also gave a negative antibody test, showing he had never had the illness. But Mrs. Mujinga's husband has insisted his wife didn't lie about being assaulted. In a statement, Luzimba Katale said Belly and her colleague were confronted and intimidated as frontline workers and their concerns and fears were ignored. More demonstrations for Black Lives Matter have been scheduled across the UK this weekend. As well as echoing US protests over the killing of George Floyd, British activists want to highlight racial assaults in Britain.
Fahana Darwood. German media are reporting that the new suspect in the Madeleine McCann case concerning a three-year-old British girl who disappeared in Portugal in 2007 has also been investigated over the disappearance of another child. A five-year-old named only as Inga went missing in the German state of Saxony-Anhalt 5 years ago. The police have refused to confirm the investigation. Jenny Hill reports.
Down a rural track next to an abandoned factory, there's a large patch of land overgrown with summer flowers. Christian B is believed to have owned the ground and stayed here sometimes in a caravan. His only neighbours, who didn't want to be interviewed on tape, told us he was secretive, coming and going, often at night, sometimes with what appeared to be his girlfriend. They also told us that detectives searched this land twice, using a digger on one occasion, in connection with the case of a missing German child. The five-year-old girl, named only as Inga, disappeared after a family party in 2015. The police have refused to confirm media reports that they investigated Christiane B. over her disappearance. But today, regional prosecutors said they were trying to establish whether there was a connection between her disappearance and that of Madeleine McCann. Meanwhile, it's emerged that German detectives, who believed that Christiane B. murdered Madeleine, were reportedly tipped off by one of his friends 3 years ago. A senior judicial source in Portugal has told the BBC that, according to German detectives, the friend was in a bar with Christiane B. on the 10th anniversary of Madeleine McCann's disappearance. As they watched the news coverage together, Christiane B. made what the informant described as a disturbing comment.
That was Jenny Hill. And finally, as we all know, it takes two to tango. But how do you perform this most sensual and physical of Argentine dances when social distancing requires you to be 2 metres apart? Much of Argentina, including the capital Buenos Aires, remains under a mandatory lockdown until June the 28th to try to contain the spread of COVID-19. And that means no dancing and no milongas, the dance sessions where tango aficionados gather. It's also mostly practiced by older generations more at risk of COVID-19. So how are they managing, especially without the famed abrazo or embrace, where couples often dance cheek to cheek? Julian Marshall spoke to Blanquita, a 95-year-old Argentine who has been dancing the tango since she was 15.
I have never gone without dancing for so long, so many months without dancing, because I love tango and I will dance tango while God gives me health, because I love it.
So how often did you go and dance the tango?
I used to go 3 times a week, sometimes 4, but always at night. On Saturdays, I used to get there between 9:30 or 10 in the evening, and I only got back home at 4 in the morning.
And how did it make you feel?
I feel very happy because it is like a hobby, like when one likes swimming or likes soccer and does it with passion. I dance with all my heart. I feel tango with passion. I love it. Now, for example, what I do is to put the radio on as soon as I wake up. I put on a station where they play tango day and night. So I live with tango. I carry it in my soul.
So you must miss it dreadfully at the moment.
And
yes, of course I miss it. During the day, I'm not so aware of it. But in the evening, I am, because that's when I used to start getting ready. And I don't think I will be able to dance again until next year, because now they have extended the quarantine. But it's okay. I am okay. I had no children, but I have a quiet life and I am a very happy person.
And I would imagine it's not just the dancing you miss, but it's also meeting friends.
Sure, I definitely do. But my friends call me every day, in the morning and in the afternoon. I am in touch with them because I am lucky. People love me very much. Everywhere I go, I am very much loved.
I mean, it takes two to tango, but do you maybe dance on your own at home?
I put on my heels and dance on my own with the broom, because I live alone and no one is allowed to come into your house. But I put on my 7 centimeter heels and I even forget my leg aches and that I have a little osteoarthritis.
Do you think it's going to be possible ever to dance the tango again like you did in the past, when Argentinians still have to keep their distance? How, for instance, are you going to be able to do the abrazo?
I don't really know, to be honest. I imagine that we will dance wearing face masks, because it will be very difficult to start hugging and putting our arms around each other again to do the abrazo, because there will still be fear. I think it would be very difficult to hug again in tango and in any other situation.
Blanquita, a 95-year-old Argentine who's been dancing the tango since she was 15. Time for me to get my shoes on with the 7-centimetre heel so I can dance off into the sunset. But don't worry, there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye.